على أهل بيت الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين لا سيما بقية الله في الأراضين روحي وأرواح العالمين له الفداء. رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي. Brothers and sisters, inshallah, today we'd like to discuss two of the verses from Surah Yusuf. So verse number 89 and verse number 90. Most of my concentration will actually be on verse number 89 tonight, though. Tonight's message will be primarily driven from verse number 89. Inshallah, tomorrow, if Allah gives tawfiq in life, then maybe we'll try and work on verse number 90. So let me read the verses in the translation, and then inshallah we will see where we go from there. We remember where we are in the story of Yusuf. The brothers of Yusuf have now come into the presence of the man they know as the Aziz. Yesterday, we covered their words to the Aziz when they were asking and begging for assistance, asking for charity, humiliating themselves and lowering themselves before the Aziz. Now we're going to talk about the response of Yusuf alayhi salam. Allah has finally given him permission to introduce himself after maybe 30, 40 years of being apart. These are his words.
قَالَ هَلْ عَلِمْتُمْ مَا فَعَلْتُمْ بِيُوسُفَ وَأَخِي إِذْ أَنْتُمْ جَاهِلُونَ.
He said, do you know, do you remember what you did to Yusuf and his brother when you were jahilun, when you were ignorant? That's the first line. The brothers are now shocked and they respond.
قَالُوا أَإِنَّكَ لَأَنْتَ يُوسُف.
Are you really Yusuf?
قَالَ أَنَا يُوسُف وَهَذَا أَخِي.
I'm Yusuf and this is my brother. Binyamin obviously is there. This is my brother.
قَدْ مَنَّ اللَّهُ عَلَيْنَا إِنَّهُ مَنْ يَتَّقِ وَيَصْبِرْ فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يُضِيعُ أَجْرَ الْمُحْسِنِينَ.
He says that if one has taqwa, one is God-weary and patient, has sabr, then Allah does not waste the reward of the virtuous. So there's a couple of points for us to get from this actual, the way that he addresses his brothers, before we even go into the lesson and then the title of tonight's speeches. I want us, inshallah, to remember what these points are because they're going to be connected to the results that we're trying to get and what we're trying to do for the cause of the imam. One thing that you notice, so the rough translation was what? That do you remember what you did to Yusuf when you were ignorant? Yusuf alayhi salam doesn't explicitly mention their sin. He doesn't say exactly what it was that they did. But he does speak to them like you speak to a criminal. Right? When you're talking to a criminal and you're telling that criminal, do you remember what you did? You know the answer. But the criminal has to, in front of you, say, yes, I'm guilty, I'm wrong. You've also noticed that Yusuf alayhi salam doesn't try and take revenge on them. Right? One would be tempted. Now, remember, imagine we were in the place of Yusuf, right? The brothers are basically groveling. They're asking, we read the verse the other day, sadaqah, please have sadaqah, have mercy, give us money, not money, but food, even though we can't pay for it, right? And these are the same brothers who did all that dirt to you. If one had any bit of ego, the temptation would be to rub it in their face a little bit. Make them beg, make, right? Yusuf does none of that, right? So, no rubbing it in their face, no ego at all. Third, another thing you've noticed about Yusuf is that Yusuf also gives his brothers a way out. This is very important for us. How did he give them a way out? He asked them, he said, do you remember what you've done to Yusuf and his brother? Of course they do remember. He says, when you were ignorant, right? He's actually giving them the answer. We can say now that we've moved on, we've grown up, we're better now. Yes, back in the day, when we were ignorant, we made this terrible mistake, but now, right? So he's actually giving them a way back, not closing the door on them, giving them the excuse. They also said that Yusuf at the same time, he didn't frighten them. This isn't in the verse. This is from some of the ahadith that we have about this incident. They said that when Yusuf spoke to them, he didn't actually want them to be frightened and terrified. You know what Yusuf did at the time when he said that? He smiled at the same time. They could see his teeth. They noticed he resembled their brother Yusuf, right? Because they might be terrified at that stage that, oh, wow, this is Yusuf. All that dirt we did, he's actually the Aziz. He's been dealing with all this time, terror, panic, fear. Now, even at that time, again, no ego from Yusuf. Just explain to them what they've done and also welcome them back. The second part of the verse is also, the next verse is also very important. In the next verse, what does Yusuf do? Yusuf explains the reason for his success. I'm Yusuf. This is my brother. Whoever has two things. One of them is patience, sabr. The other is taqwa. Then God doesn't neglect or waste the work of those people who are righteous. By Yusuf doing this at the height of his success and his power and glory, actually he's inviting them to these two wonderful things. Okay. Now, that's a little bit about the thing. And before I get to the topic tonight, so we have a topic. We discuss strategy here in the masajid and the majalis. Right, we discuss strategy. For us, these majalis of Imam al-Hussein are like a war room, right, where we talk about the most strategic and important issues for the coming of the Imam and what we have to do in order to get him to return, right? But before we get to that, there's a little bit of a message that we can get from Yusuf alayhi salam. One of them is, and I hope you guys don't mind, this generation sometimes is a little bit brittle and soft. This generation, us, right? Sometimes when you look at the miseries and sadness that we're going through and what breaks us down and we're ready to go to pieces, you feel like this generation is just a little bit soft, right? Let's go back to the story of Yusuf. Yusuf is a man who was robbed of his childhood. Basically orphaned while he was a child. Sold into slavery by his brothers. His brothers sold him into slavery. Did time in prison. Time in the joint, right? Yusuf in the story, he went to prison. He spent time in prison. Why did he go to prison? Remember the temptation? The temptation was, right? He could have had all of the dunya that he wanted to by giving in to Zuleika. But he refused to give in to Zuleika, the wife of the Azi. He refused to give in. So when he refused to give in, she became his enemy. So suddenly, now I am the enemy of the wife of the person who is perhaps the second most powerful man in Egypt, and I'm a foreigner. What we say in America is that hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. Right? You made an enemy, and now it's personal. She hates you. Right? So Yusuf went through all of those difficulties, and then by the grace of Allah, by sabr, having patience, and taqwa, he's able to come out victorious. But sometimes what happens, unfortunately, people like me, when we go through difficulties, we start to think it's the end of the world. We haven't been sold into slavery. We haven't been put in prison, for instance. But with misery and sadness and suffering. And there's some ahadith that are a little bit scary in this regard. If somebody really breaks down really easily, this is the hadith. It's from Imam Ali. He says, "Man azzama sagair al-masa'ib." Whoever makes a big deal out of small musibah and small difficulties, what happens? What does Allah do to that person? If the person doesn't have sabr, if they're not patient, if they go to pieces, what happens if somebody gives up because of small problems in their life? This is what he says. Ibtalahu Allah bikaba'iriha. Allah gives somebody like that big test and trials to face. I'm sure sometimes if the malaika, they're listening to us and they see our problems and problems, they probably look at one another and they're surprised. Serious? Are you kidding me? The malaika. And they're looking at us. This guy's going to pieces over this? Are you kidding me? If the malaika could talk to us, you know, suck it up, princess. Really? Malaika, how are you? falling to pieces over these things? So sometimes what happens is this generation is a little bit more brittle than they should be, not ready to face big problems and challenges like Yusuf. So we want to work on that and make sure that we have that sabr and that taqwa. Now, what we want to talk about tonight is this verse reminds us of an important lesson. That important lesson is, one, human potential and the importance of human capital. Remember I said we would talk about things which are strategic, of greatest importance to us, inshallah, for these majalis? One of the things that we want to keep in mind is the idea that the importance of, first of all, human potential. This story of Yusuf and his brothers, one of the reasons it's so beautiful is it's a story where everybody ends up on the right path. These brothers who are in here, right? These guys, what was their crimes? They were contemplating murder of a minor, right, from the beginning of the story of Yusuf, ready to murder their own brother. Kidnapping of the child of a prophet, betraying the trust of their father, lying. These guys were bad, bad guys. But Yusuf alayhi salam was able to do something where these guys all end up on the right path. So one of them is human potential. Somebody could be that wicked, that bad, and still be saved. Important. In addition to that, the importance of human capital, right? The idea, like Yusuf and his father, they were able to get these boys who were apparently that wicked, but able to get them to serve the cause of Islam. So we want to keep that in our minds. The reason that's so important is that we human beings are the greatest of Allah's creation. The greatest of Allah's creation. And as the brother mentioned in the speech before mine, we actually want to save mankind. We want to save as many of God's creation as possible. As many of God's creation as possible. Not only Shias, not only as many Shias as we can, but also our Sunni brethren. Not only them, even non-Muslims, the oppressed amongst the non-Muslims. We want to save as many of them as possible, right? You know what the hadith tell us about the value of each human being? This first hadith is from Imam Sadiq, salamullahi alayhi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. He says, "An-nasu ma'adin ka ma'adin al-dhahabi wal-fidda." People are mines. Like mines of gold and silver, people are treasure troves, right? The potential that human beings have to serve God, to get close to Allah, is greater than that of the malaika and the jinn. And any of Allah's creation, we're actually that good if we can be pushed in the right direction. Yusuf and his father, Yaqub, because of their patience, were able to do something that these boys came back to the right path and were able to be good Muslims. But what happens is if they're not given tarbiyah, or God forbid people reject tarbiyah, they won't want to be trained, the human potential for wickedness and bad is like no other. This hadith is, "An-nas ma'adin fil khair wal shar." They can be also minds of goodness or wickedness. So what we want to do is to save as many people as possible. Unity and trying to work with the oppressed of the world is absolutely important to us. One of the things we don't want to do, brothers and sisters, is we don't want to allow this problem of ISIS to divide the Muslim ummah. When we're talking about strategy now and how close we are to the coming of the imam and the plans that the enemies had and why they created them, why they're supporting them, why they're promoting them, one of the things you and I are trying to do, we have to be more clever than that, we can't fall into the trap of the enemy. The enemy would like to see us divided over this issue to make it a Shia-Sunni issue. Of course, we can't let that happen. There is an open letter. You guys may have seen it online. The letter was created by a group in America called CARE, an umbrella organization which defends Muslims' rights. But if you look on that letter, you'll see that so many prominent Sunni scholars are disassociating themselves from ISIS. That we have nothing to do, trying to disprove their arguments. Now, whether we agree with all of their arguments in istidlal, right? But they're trying, they're making effort. So what the enemies want is the opposite. That no, we lump, for instance, us Shias, we say, they're all like this, our all Sunni brethren are like this. This is a Shia Sunni, they're butchering Shias. Right? And we can't fall into that trap. For us, our Sunni brothers and sisters, I'm sure a lot of you know me, I wasn't always Shia. My father and mother weren't even Muslim. They became Muslim. I was born Sunni Muslim. I became Shia. A lot of those same youth who you see out there, those people you would think, oh, they're just like myself. They haven't been exposed to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. The enemy see the effectiveness that you're having on the ground and how true Islam will spread. They know how effective you are, will create a group like this. Get the Muslims involved in bloodshed and killing one another in order to stop the spread of Islam in the name of Islam. But the Shia is not supposed to be simple. We know that people fought Imam Ali by putting the Quran on spears. It's easy for us to see that, no, you have a group, you create a group, apparently they're very hardcore Muslims, you're using them to fight Islam. But us, because we're trying to save as many, even our Sunni brothers, even non-Muslims, as many people as possible, we can't fall into their traps. So now let's go to our lesson. What's our lesson for tonight? Our lesson is this: showing others light at the end of the tunnel. Showing others. One time I see the light at the end of the tunnel. I see that Islam is the truth. I see this is the way. Another time I'm dealing with other people. This is now of strategic importance for activists. How can I show others light at the end of the tunnel? Make them also see that this is the way. Bring them also in the right direction. That's the lesson that we want to get. And we see, obviously, in that verse, when Yusuf would address the boys who had done so much dirt, but the mission and the idea is to bring them back to God, and even when he is reprimanding them and saying that, do you remember what you did to Yusuf? Even then, he gives them a way back. He shows them that there is light. There is a way for them to return. So, for us, we want to make sure that's important. The first lesson for us to keep in mind, if we want to be like that, we want to be like Yusuf, not only do we want to see the light, not only do we want to save ourselves, but we want to see as many as humanity who can make it saved. And it's a little bit tough now. It starts with refinement of the soul. I'd like to go over and save other people. If you remember now to those first lessons we got from Yusuf, one of them was the idea that Yusuf didn't have any ego. That's not something that comes overnight, brothers and sisters. One of the reasons that we, practicing Muslims, sometimes are not effective in bringing others to the right way or as effective as we could be is that our actions are not done with ikhlas. And I start with myself. Because our actions are not done with ikhlas, we're not able to draw others in as we would like to. So the process of saving everybody else begins with us saving ourselves. So we have to actually refine ourselves. We have to take that on as a mission. Now what we learn, though, is that many times we don't see that the solution is simply attending majalis. Right? Many of us have been attending majalis all of our lives. And alhamdulillah, there is great barakah, blessings in attending the majalis and being part of them, the spiritual charge that we get. Many of us, we come for Muharram for these 10 days to get the charge that we need for the rest of the year, up until Ramadan, right? But question, we've been attending majalis for years now. Have we felt that attending majalis itself is enough? Or do we look back at ourselves and we still see that our character is not the way it ought to be? The answer is that there's something else out there also. Let me bring you back to the time of the Holy Prophet. When we're looking at books of senior ulama and explaining the seerah of the Holy Prophet, how was it that he was able to get society to refine itself? The Prophet, what he did was that he would mentor people one-on-one. Saving the society or saving ourselves first before we save everybody else, the idea is it's not sufficient for us only to attend majalis and we're sitting, let's say there's 200 of us, 300 of us in a room. That's important. We must do that. In addition to that, what did the Prophet do? He would mentor individuals one-on-one. He'd get to know you.
He'd sit down with you. He'd talk with you.
What we learn from the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen is that this job of mentoring, of bringing people to the higher stages of Iman, was primarily that of the prophets. What is he saying? When he's talking about the philosophy of why Allah sent prophets, he says, وَيُثِيرُ لَهُمْ دَفَاءَنَ الْأُقُولِ. One of the jobs of these prophets was that they would unearth for the people, they would mine, excavate for the people, what? Their buried intellects. A lot of the potential for doing good, for understanding, for doing the right way, for purifying ourselves, that's there, but it has to be unearthed. We need somebody to actually do that excavating, mining. So what was the job of the holy prophets? The prophets would mentor people. That was their job. Now what do we do in the absence of prophets? We're trying to prepare ourselves for an imam who's waiting on us, and we have to get our act together. For those of us who don't have access to the prophet, this is the job now of ulama. But we learn from the ahadith that the ulama are the inheritors of the prophet, and that job of taking us from the level of just practicing our wajibat to the higher levels of spirituality, mentoring us, is actually a job that we want to approach qualified ulama for. From the majalis of Imam Hussein, we get that spiritual boost. But now the idea is, which one of us has spiritual ambition? I want to go to the higher stages. Islam has talked about a lot of things. I'm going to give you some examples of people who had purified their souls. How do I get there? That same seerah of the Holy Prophet, one-on-one attention, being mentored. There's no way one person could give out one prescription for 1,000 people at one time. If I went to the doctor and I had a physical disease, would I go to the doctor, or we just have 1,000 people sitting in the room, and the doctor write out one prescription for everybody? Take this one red pill and everything will be okay. Or would each one of us have to go and say, doctor, this is my condition. I'm sick in this way. I have a cough. I have a fever, right? And then you would get a personalized prescription. So that's what you saw in the seerah of the Holy Prophet. That the seerah of the Holy Prophet was that one-on-one attention. Where do we get that now from? From the ulama. That's what's supposed to happen. Now, the next one, again now, how can we bring others on the right path? The Ahlul Bayt have made it a bit more challenging. You know what the Ahlul Bayt want from us? That we lead others by example. The Ahlul Bayt haven't made it easy. Imam, I've learned that I need to be like Yusuf, and I need to save as many people as possible. I have to start, of course, with saving myself. How do you want me to do that? I don't want you to do it with words. I want you to do it with your actions. Let me read you the hadith. The hadith says this. This is for those who have positions of leadership, and all of us have somehow a position of leadership. We have a circle of influence. We have people who listen to us. What does he say? مَنْ نَصَبَ نَفْسَهُ لِلنَّاسِ إِمَامًا. Whoever sets himself up as an imam for people. I have a circle of influence. There are people who are listening to me. People who I could affect. People who I could bring on the right way. What does the imam tell us to do? He says to start by teaching ourselves before we teach others. First let me teach myself, then others. What else does the imam say? وَلْيَكُنْ تَعْدِيبُهُ بِسِيرَتِهِ قَبْلَ تَعْدِيبِهِ بِلِسَانِهِ. He says the training that we give of other people with our tongues, that should be secondary. First with our actions. That they should see our actions and be so impressed, that leads them to God in the right way. Let me give you one example. Remember I told you guys before that the shuhada, Allah chooses the best of mankind and allows them to become shaheed. I'm going to give you some examples from Karbala. But before we get to Karbala, let's look at modern times. These Islamic values are not things that only existed 1,400 years ago. There were individuals, even now, young people, who were able to work on themselves, refine themselves, and become these people who lead by their words. I'll give you an example of one of the shuhada. This person, his name was Mahdi. The guy who's describing the story, his name is Wahid. Wahid's explaining what happens. He says that I was standing outside of the barracks. It's like after Maghrib now. The sun is about to set or is setting. And I'm trying to hail down a car to get back to the barracks. Every time, it's been a half an hour now, been waiting, waving, trying to hail down every single car that passes, and everybody's driving past. Finally, I see one car drive down. I scream out, "Barracks!" I think the guy's going to go by, but I see the car stops. It backs up. So excited, I pick up my bag. I start running over to the car. It's a cream-colored Toyota truck running over to the car. The guy rolls down the window, Mahdi. I don't know his name at this time. "Where are you going?" "To the barracks." "Bismillah." He sits inside the car. So they start to talk. "What are you doing here?" "Actually," he says, "that I'm an art student. I joined the barracks and I wanted to serve the cause, but since I'm an art student, I want to paint the pictures of the shuhada." He said, "I was out a little bit late because I didn't know what take this, it was that difficult to get a car, but that's what happened." So they're riding and they're talking and stuff like that. The guy tells him, he says, that what you're doing is not less than those that the shuhada are doing. By fighting in the battlefront, what you're doing by remembering them, by drawing their picture, by keeping them in mind, this is something which is no less than that. He drops him back at the barracks. Then he remembers, "I don't even know this guy's name." And the guy drives off. It's too late for me to hail the guy down. He says, after that, once I got into the barracks, I was too busy to get a chance to meet the guy. The guy came to meet me a couple of times. He would come by, he would meet me, we would be talking. I'd be showing my pictures. And I noticed that when he would look at the pictures of the shuhada, I would see longing in his face, as if he's lonely, as if he misses them. So we're over there, we're talking and stuff like that. Then I remembered, "Look, I don't even know your name." I said, "What's your name?" He said, "My name isn't important. I'm your younger brother. Call me servant of God." Servant of God. He says, "Okay, servant of God it is." He notices, now stories about this. So he noticed his friend would come by in certain times. One time he said, "It was so hot outside, I was ready to faint from exhaustion. I see my friend over there, the servant of God, and he's picking up garbage off the ground." So I tell him, I said, "Why are you over here picking up garbage?" He grabs his hand, tries to stop him. "Why are you picking up garbage off the ground? Aren't there workers to pick up garbage?" He says, "Look, we're all Basiji. We all came here to serve God. You should help me pick up garbage too." He says, "No, me? No, I'm not here to, workers, I'm not going to pick up any garbage." He says, "Why don't you come to my unit? I can get some lemonade for you. I can hook you up. Why don't you join my unit?" His friend, the servant of God, says, "No, I'm happy where I am." He says, "Okay." So the story continues. Every once in a while, his friend is coming to visit him, talk to him and stuff like that. And he's over there painting his pictures. Till one day, somebody throws a rock and hits him in the back of the neck. When they hit them with the rock in the back of the neck, he turns around. He's angry. It messed up the painting. He turns around. It's one of his other friends, Hussein. Hussein comes over. "Hussein, so what's going on? What's the story?" His friend Hussein is one of the commanders of the battalion, one of the commanders. A junior commander, for instance, but a commander. "How are you doing? What are you doing here? You've drawn pictures." Right? They start talking. He says, "Why don't you come have lunch with me? We can go meet the commander of the entire base." He says, "What a business do I have with the commander of the base? Why don't you and I, we'll sit down, we'll have lunch together. We don't need to go over and meet the..." He says, "No, come over. At lunchtime, you can meet the commander of the entire base." He says, "Actually, I would love to do that." They end up going. When he goes over to meet the commander of the base, he sees his friend, the one who's picking up the garbage, the one who was driving that truck, and he's standing outside the door of the commander. "Hey, how are you doing?" He said, "Oh, what are you..." Right? He said, you're a driver for the commander." Right? And the guy's just shaking his hand, welcoming him, and he knows his friend's starting to turn colors, get pale. "What are you doing?" He says, "Well, don't talk to him. Like, come." He says, "Well, what's the matter? That's my friend. That's the guy I was trying to introduce you to." The guy takes him aside. He says, "That's the commander of the entire base." He says after that they had been invited to lunch. He's so embarrassed now. I was treating the commander like slapping him on the back, talking like this, calling him, telling him that his name was servant of God, right? He says after that he felt so ashamed he couldn't hardly even eat there. He waited till the commander was distracted because the commander was just treating him like everything else. Then he left. He walked away. He goes back to his room. Mahdi comes back to see him in his room. He welcomes him. The idea being that if we can be those people who have absolutely no ego, our Islamic work, our material success, our financial success, the titles we've acquired, none of that has changed us in the least. We're not looking for recognition, not even letting people know who we are, serving silently unknown soldiers of the 12th Imam. That kind of sincerity is what will help bring about the Imam's return. So what happens now is that we want to be people like this, those people who are bringing everybody else back to the right path, showing them the way, telling them that there's light at the end of the tunnel, right? And each one of us, you and I, all of us have a role in doing this. All of us have a role in doing this. Even for our sisters, they have a role in leading their families also. When we talk about this idea of leadership, we're talking about leading by example, each person doing their responsibility to lead others towards the right path. Now, the question comes, how, let's say, for example, right, just give some practical examples, how should women be leading their families in the right way? And the example I want to give of the shuhada, the shaheed of Karbala, is about a mother. Okay, how should women be leading their families in the right way? How should we as fathers, or as sons, or daughters, or as children, how can we be doing this? So we, like Yusuf, are showing everybody where the light is at the end of the tunnel. With our sisters leading and people towards God doesn't mean that they have to be harsh or negative. Right? Being very much manly, in your face, shouting and screaming. Right? No. That kind of leadership isn't what we're looking for. I remember hearing a story once about the CIA recruit. It's not a true story. They said that once the CIA had come up to these three individuals, these are top agents of the CIA, and they told them, they said that we're looking for a special person for this job. Only three people made it. One of them was a woman and there were two guys. After they had passed all of their tests and they came over to lead them to the room, they said, you have to go into this room, they told the guy, and you'll find your wife blindfolded in there, handcuffed, go in there, pull the trigger, and then you're the person for the job. The first person, when he heard that, he said, no, I can't do that. Go in and kill my wife. No. He said, okay, you're not the man for the job. Get out of here. Don't tell anybody what you've seen. They invited the second guy. They told him, your wife's inside the room. She's handcuffed and blinded. Go over there. You have to pull the trigger, and then you'll get the job. The guy goes inside the room. For a minute, he's silent. Then he comes back out. He's crying. He says, I can't do it. Finally, there's only the lady left. They tell the lady, they say that your husband is in the room. He's blindfolded. You have to pull the trigger. And she goes into the room. They hear loud bang, bang, bang. Then they hear shouting and screaming and banging. Till finally the lady comes out of the room and she's sweating. She says, the gun was full of blanks. I had to kill him with the chair. So some people are like that. A harsh kind of is. No, actually, the way of, let's say, the example of the wife would be that of being soft and feminine, not being a doormat, right? But actually inviting her husband to the right way or her children to the right way, right? If it's her husband, for instance, the idea in Islam is that the man is the leader of the household, right? So she'll explain to him what Islam wants, lead by example, make her point known, but he's also the leader of the house, right? If women would do that, the hadith tell us that men are pretty simple, and that women have the gift of being able to steal their intellect. We have that in hadith. That women can steal the intellect of a man. If she's feminine and does all the right things, 100%. Right? So for us, again, the idea is leading by example, doing what our duty is. Not the idea of being negative, that ISIS type of Islam. But responsibility, leading by example. Yes, going and speaking and saying what our responsibility is, actually that is necessary, and we do need to make sure we do that. The other thing to keep in mind is this. What do we tell people who may have strayed? Or even ourselves. Even ourselves. Let's say that we haven't been practicing Islam as we should be, right? Now is the month of Muharram. Now we want to go over and do the right thing. Now we want to get closer to God. What do we tell ourselves? What do we tell others? There are some beautiful ahadith from the Ahlul Bayt which give us encouragement in this regard. There's one of them from Amirul Mu'mineen. What Amirul Mu'mineen tells us, right? No matter what position we are in life, no matter what we may have done before, back to that story of Yusuf and how bad his brothers were and how Yusuf was able to bring them back to the right path and they were able to make Tawbah and go back to him. What does the hadith tell us? They tell us, the rest of your life is priceless. Baqiyatul umr la qimata laha. That the rest of your life is priceless. So if we're talking to ourselves or others, people maybe made mistakes, maybe weren't perfect people in the past, now I can make a change. Now I can make a change. And each one of us is important to the cause. We saw how Yusuf was patient for 40 years and got his brothers, him and his father, were able to bring his brother to the right path. Each and every one of us, despite our flaws and our weaknesses, each one of us is also useful for the cause. Right? As many people as we're able to save, it's also necessary. So that's one of the points for us to keep in mind. The other one to keep in mind is this. No matter what stage of iman and faith I'm at, right? Even if I've slipped and even if I've made some mistakes, when you see me and you're trying to talk to me to save me, remember to encourage me to continue doing whatever good I can do. There's some people, when they see somebody who's made a lot of mistakes, slipping, falling, they may be tempted to tell the person, just forget it. Just forget it. I'll give you one example. There was a brother who would be offering his prayers, and when he was offering his prayers, he would see he was taking off his t-shirt. So why are you taking off your t-shirt? And the brother explains, he says that actually, my t-shirt's stolen. Right? And I know if I make salat with a stolen t-shirt, my salat's batil. So I take it off, make salat, and then I put my stolen t-shirt back on. Okay? Now, the person who's wise would say that even with that person, okay, it's not good that he stole. We're not justifying his lifestyle. But should we snuff out that little bit of light that he has, that nur that's there, trying to do the right thing? Or should we encourage that, even if it's a little bit? Even if we keep that little bit of nur alive, later that can lead to great change. Let me read you the hadith about this, and then inshallah we'll go to Karbala. The hadith says this, لَا تُحَقِّرَنَّ حَسَنَةً, that never consider any hasana, any good deed that you're doing to be little, وَإِن صَغُرَتْ عِنْدَكْ, even if you consider it to be small, وَقَلَّتْ فِي عَيْنِكْ. Why should that be the case? The Imam tells us, فَإِنَّهَا سَتَسُرُّكَ يَوْمًا. One day, that little good deed that you're doing will be so useful to you on the day of judgment, right? So we don't want to, I'm doing this small thing. No, whatever good I can do, however I can contribute, we want to make sure that we encourage people to do that. Now, with your permission, we'd like to go briefly to Karbala. Inshallah, when I recite these lines of the ziyarah, inshallah, you'll recite them with me. And we'll try to kind of close our eyes and imagine that we're there in the lands of Karbala and we're witnessing this sacrifice. Tonight's sacrifice, as I was telling you, is about a young boy and a mother. I'm going to go over there and mention the sacrifice that they made for the Imam of the time. As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah. وعلى الأرواح التي حلت بفنائك عليك مني سلام الله أبدا ما بقيت وبقي الليل والنهار ولا جعله الله آخر العهد مني لزيارتكم السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. Brothers and sisters, our dream is to be sacrificed for the Imam of the time and to have that sacrifice accepted. Before I tell you the story of that shaheed, I want to remind you of a shaheed who we all hope that we could be like. He was a Turkish slave of the Imam. The story of this shaheed is that he went out. He's a slave. He has nobody. He's owned. He's property of another. But he wants to sacrifice himself in the way of the Imam. This shaheed went forward. He went and he fought. And then after he killed a number of the enemy, he fell to the ground. They said when Imam Hussein saw this, he came over to the broken body of this young man as he lay on the ground. They said the imam started to cry when he saw him. And then the imam placed his holy face on the face of that shaheed. وَضَعَ خَدَهُ عَلَى خَدَهُ He placed his holy face, his cheek on the cheek of that shaheed. And that shaheed woke up at that time with his mawla, his master, his face on his face. They said the shaheed started to smile, and that's how he left and met his Lord. But the shaheed I want to talk about is an example of perfect Islamic etiquette, how families should be with one another. As parents, how we want to raise our children. The line that this shaheed would recite when he would go to battle was this line. Amiri Hussein wa ni'mal amir. My amir is Hussein, and what an excellent amir he is. They say that after, in the Battle of Karbala, a young man came out to offer himself for the imam of his time. Thumma kharaja shabun. A young man came out to offer himself for the imam, offer himself in the way of Allah. But this young man was special. He wasn't like everybody else. His father had also become shaheed, and his mother was also there on the battlefield. But when his mother saw the loneliness of the son of Fatima, she ordered her young son to come out. She told him, "Ukhruj ya bunayya wa qatil bayna yaday ibn Rasulillah." Go over and fight in the way of the son of the Prophet. And this young man came over and he asked permission from the imam of his time. And the imam told him no. He said, "This is a young man. Qutila abu, his father's been killed. Maybe his mother is upset. Maybe she doesn't want him to go out and fight." The young boy spoke to the imam. He told the imam, "Ummi amaratni bidhalik." My mother's the one who came over and told me to go out and fight. So he came out after he got permission from his imam and he started to fight. Now he was a young man. He didn't have, his father maybe wasn't a famous person. He didn't have anything to honor himself by. Normally people would recite poetry, maybe mention their achievements, accomplishments. All of he could think about was about his imam. Amiri Hussein wa ni'mal amir. And he went over and he fought till finally he was killed in the way of Allah. They said his head was decapitated and his head was thrown back towards the camp of Imam Hussein. His mother was proud of him though. He went over and she picked up the head and she said, "Ahsant ya bunay, excellent my son. You've made me proud." Allah la'anatullah 'ala al-qawm al-zalimin wa say'lamu alladhina zalamu ayyamun qalibin yanqalibun.